Welcome. This is Dr. Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today we're pleased to have Dr. David Biro, who's the author of The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. Dr. Biro has an MD from Columbia University and a PhD in literature from Oxford University, which I'm sure was very useful in writing this book. And as a physician, as practicing physician, I'm sure that he understands the importance of communicating and evaluating our patient's pain, and he also has some personal experience with his own pain, and he's here to share that with us. Thank you, David. I appreciate you spending some time on a Saturday.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, you want to tell the listeners a little bit about your own experience and what led you to write this book?
Well, this book has actually been many years in the making and thinking. It started actually as a project in graduate school. I was doing English literature, and I was thinking about the suffering of characters in my favorite novels and how authors were able to express these very difficult to express experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the first life of the thought process. Then I actually went to medical school and became a doctor, and then was actually confronted by real life people in pain who always, it seemed to me, had difficulty talking and communicating their pain.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the second thread. And then finally, I was a patient shortly after finishing my residency. I became a patient myself and had to have a bone marrow transplant. I had the very rare blood disorder and had a bone marrow transplant and suffered a lot of pain. And so I think that was the final straw,
yeah.
Which really motivated me that I really have to write a book about this because
mm-hmm.
it's so important. I just think about an image of myself in the hospital when things were at their worst after lots of chemotherapy and radiation before my transplant. I was really in a lot of pain, and at that moment, you know, I just, even though I was surrounded by my family, my wife, I really felt completely cut off. I was cut off, and part of the reason that I felt like that, even though people were close by, you know, in proximity, was that communication really just fell away.
Mm-hmm.
I felt I was in my own sort of world of pain that no one could sort of reach to. So I think that was the sort of emotional point that sort of drove me to really think about this and put it into a book at some point. So that's the long answer to your short question.
Okay. Well, it seems that a theme in your book is that pain makes us turn inward. We're no longer interested in what's in the external world. We look for meaning in our pain, and we're going to discuss all of that hopefully in the next hour. But I wanted to relate to you some of my personal experiences and then my experiences as a surgeon and get your take on it, because I did not see, other than I know that you talked about Jack London in your book,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. about Jack that I wanted to share with you as well. But my first experience that I could remember with really bad pain was viral meningitis, and I think I was about 13, and the pain was so bad that I couldn't close my eyes, and it was just all encompassing. And then all of a sudden, I found myself out of my body. I was no longer in pain. And I went around, I was in my brother's apartment, and I went around the apartment, and I even went into other rooms and looked and came back, and I don't think I was having a hallucination because it was very, very real. And then finally I went back into my body and experienced the pain again. And then years later, when I was a surgeon, I was at a level one trauma center in the military, and an OBGYN doctor had been acting as a farmer in the tractor to and a disc barrow to do some work on his land, and had an accident. The disc barrow and the tractor both ran over him, and he broke every rib in four different places in his body. So there were you know, four sets of fractures of all ribs, as you can imagine. Rib fractures are pretty painful.
Mm.
Plus a pneumothorax as it went through his nipple and caused a pneumothorax and some other vascular injuries and abdominal injuries. And when I came down to see him, he was intubated because his pressure was so low. And they told me he was on Coumadin, which isn't good, obviously.
Mm.
And he kept doing the little thing that we do when we want to indicate morphine or, you know, a painkiller, which is
mm-hmm.
the shot thing with your hands, you
mm-hmm.
know. He literally couldn't speak because he was intubated.
Right.
And I kept saying, well, you know, doctor, what was your last PT? And he gave me with his fingers and everything. I took him upstairs to the operating room, and I said to anesthesia, is he asleep? And they said, go ahead. And I said, is he out? Go ahead. And so I opened his belly, took out his spleen, which was entirely avulsed. And at that time, I just reached in, took his spleen out. It wasn't attached to anything. And of course, he was bleeding like crazy because of the Coumadin.
Mm-hmm.
And I said cuss word.
Right.
It starts with an S, okay.
Right.
which we sometimes say in surgery when we're really in dire straits, as you can imagine. But anyway,
right.
I went ahead and did his surgery, stopped the bleeding, closed him up, and then he went into the ICU for about a year. And when he went into the ICU, he actually had to have cardiothoracic put plates on him because he had a flail chest so bad that he had to be plated to not have a flail chest. Vascular surgery did some vascular surgery on him because he had a intimal tear of his main subclavian, you know, and he was a surgeon, obviously, as an OBGYN doctor, and they were worried he would throw a clot to that on. But anyway, he went through all these surgeries, and before he left the hospital, I went to visit him. And this is what he told me. It's very interesting. He said, I remember every word you said in surgery, including, oh, you know, the cut.
Right.
And he said, but I didn't feel you cut into my belly because my chest pain was so severe. Which brings me to the point, and as a surgeon, I can tell you that's true. When we have severe pain in one part of our body, we often don't feel pain in another part. And you can do this, you can use this to your advantage if you're having surgery. You have multiple surgeries, you know, you have surgery done in multiple areas of your body and only one area will hurt. It's very true, but it's interesting, in many cases anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so he told me that once he went into the ICU, he popped out of his body and he went fishing. And he did this and he described all the things he did, but he wasn't in his body, he wasn't in the ICU. And then he went back into his body when it was better healed, and then he was discharged. You know, he was moved to the step-down unit,
right.
And he was discharged. He went back to work. He had five kids. He needed to. And
right.
In the meantime, his wife died of breast cancer, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So the breast cancer being an abandonment issue sometimes when people are feel that they are being abandoned or betrayed by people who are supposed to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, that's a whole other interview.
Right.
But isn't it interesting that it may be that we are not given more pain than we can bear, that we have this escape mechanism?
Mm-hmm.
And I bring up Jack London because it's well known that Jack London could leave his body and travel extensively, and he wrote about it, you know, as an author. So it's very, and I think he had depression. Didn't Jack
mm-hmm.
have depression?
I think he had lots of.
Right. But isn't it interesting that he learned to leave his body to get away from that pain? And
mm-hmm.
I don't know whether it was physical pain or it was probably psychological pain, which
mm-hmm.
many people say is even worse than physical pain.
Yeah.
I was going to interview Andrew Solomon,
mm-hmm.
Solomon, the author of The Noonday Demon, but
sure.
he canceled because he felt so bad. Isn't that interesting?
You mean just now, for this, or at another time you were going to interview?
Yeah. I had him set up for an interview, but he called to cancel because he didn't feel like
right.
he could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that interesting that, well, obviously he has major, major problems with depression, even
yeah.
in spite of all of the modern day treatments that we have, which are not effective in all instances. Just like mm-hmm. with, in your book, you say that, you know, the woman with the risk who's taken 3 Percocets and her husband can't imagine that 3 Percocets wouldn't cure any pain.
Right.
Pain can be very resistant, especially neuropathic pain. I treat a lot of RSD.
Mm-hmm.
I treat a lot of neuropathic pain. I'm a hand surgeon as well as a surgeon who treats cancer. So obviously, and we have a cancer clinic, so obviously I see a lot of terminal patients
mm-hmm.
with significant pain. And some pain is very resistant to any
mm-hmm.
treatment.
Well, certainly the chronic pain, I mean, there's according to many physicians and pain
mm-hmm.
experts, there's a real chronic pain epidemic in this country, and medicine hasn't really responded very well to the needs of many of these patients
no.
for a lot of reasons.
They don't understand it.
They don't understand. I mean, they're not educated.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how educated were you in pain management in medical
not
school?
Much. Not much.
And yet, it is the single most common presenting symptom when you go to the doctor.
Right.
So it's an odd kind of thing that pain isn't such an important, or at least it doesn't get a lot of attention in the medical school curriculum, and so many doctors feel uncomfortable about treating pain. And then, of course, there's probably not as many pain specialists in this country as we need.
No, there aren't, because it takes months to get in to see many of them.
Uh huh. And then there's a research issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pain doesn't quite get the attention in research dollars as breast
mm-hmm.
cancer
right.
or other things. So there's a lot going on, and there's a lot that can be done to you know, there's a lot of deficiencies currently when it comes
mm-hmm.
to pain management. I think particularly, as you said, for the chronic pain sufferers who seem to go from doctor to doctor and never sort of find anything that really helps too much.
Well, I have an interesting practice in that I have over 2,000 patients who are sick from silicone and saline implant disease,
mm-hmm.
which is a combination of chemical and biotoxicity. Now, these women have been to multiple doctors, all of whom, you know, put them on antidepressants, put them on, you know, Klonopin, put them on sleep things, tell them they have fibromyalgia, but it's not related to their implants, even though there's peer-reviewed literature that the FDA helped pay for, saying that it is, you know, because studies get into the literature that actually show us what's going on. There was a whole journal in 96 on the toxicity of silicone.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed Dr. Arthur Brower, who was one of the editors of that, and yet I don't know of any plastic surgeons other than myself that actually know that there is a journal on toxicology of silicone, because they've been all taught to believe that silicone is not toxic.
Right.
But it is. But it's funny, because silicone is actually a hazardous substance. So what do you do with that? And,
right.
And it's illegal to inject silicone into the body. And in fact, I just had an email sent to me from one of the groups I'm on, showing that somebody just died in Atlanta of a silicone injection into the buttocks, you know, pulmonary complications of silicone embolus. But it's okay for that implant to rupture and to travel extensively, especially along the nerves and into the lymphatics. And that's not a problem. That can't possibly be causing your pain.
Right, right.
Now, you know, what is going on here? Did,
right.
did all of these doctors simply lose their capacity to reason?
Right.
And the surgeons are really guilty, because they go in there and see the mess. They see the fungus, they culture and see the methicillin resistant staph around there. I mean, why wouldn't they think that that could cause pain?
Mm.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
I believe that the medical profession has a tremendous capacity to ignore factual data and an even greater capacity to ignore non-factual things like a complaint of pain. You know, like, you know, the patient says, I'm in a, you know, 9 out of 10 pain here, and the doctor just can't conceive of it. Probably because the doctor's never been in a 9 out of 10 pain.
All right. And not to, I mean, I agree with this, but I think it's not so easy, you know. I mean, there really is no sort of objective way to, you know, quantify and qualify another person's pain.
Well, can I interject
sure.
here for a second? Because there is one. You know, I've done this radio show for 17 years. For 17 years, I've talked to scientists, physicists, authors, and Dr. Valerie Hunt, she's mm-hmm. like 88 now, she's a physiologist at UCLA. She actually developed a machine to quantify pain
mm-hmm.
that works. It reads the frequency of red in the aura or etheric field. And it's very interesting because this could be used to quantify pain, and especially like in cases of workman's comp, I do a lot of that, where the, you know, the company's saying they're faking.
Right.
You know, I kind of, as a clinician, say, yeah, you know, this person's faking, but this person isn't, because you can kind of tell
right.
when you've been at it long enough.
Right.
But this could quantify pain. So actually, there
like
is...
Like a lie detector test.
It's actually based on physics, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's based on biophysics. And you can buy one. So, you know, it's not... there's actually a huge amount of things in medicine that people just don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did, they would be able to do things like quantify pain or a number of other things. You know, people say... that you know, that all these other things aren't possible, but yet there's examples of them. I'm looking at a book right now put out by Noetic Science called Spontaneous Remission.
Mm-hmm.
100 documented cases of spontaneous remission, many of which are physically impossible.
Right.
Isn't that interesting? You know, like regrowing a hip bone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how do you explain that? But, you know,
here's the only thing that bothers me about a machine that we need to decide whether somebody else is in pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why can't we just say that pain is at bottom, at heart, a subjective experience, and we have to accept the word of a person who says they're in pain or and whose behavior shows and is, you know, shows that there is pain. Why shouldn't the first impulse be to accept
because
that?
Because basically when you're working in the world of workman's comp or
right.
insurance,
I don't work in work.
You know, because the, I mean, this is what they do, and they should do this. I'm not criticizing them, but they have been burnt so often by people saying having a minor back injury at work, you know, lifting
right.
up something weighing less than 30 pounds and then all of a sudden having excruciating pain. And then not ever being able to work again. And yet, when they send detectives or private detectives out, they videotape them lifting 80-pound bags of feed onto their truck.
Right,
okay?
Right.
So that's why, because essentially, too often,
right.
people with less ethics than they should have been trying to bilk insurance companies.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not, and doctors go into two camps. Doctors go into those who say there is absolutely no evidence, nothing is wrong with this patient, even though the patient has. I read one the other day, it was hilarious, that the patient had a laceration of his wrist tendon and that wasn't repaired. And this is a major, the major wrist tendon, flexor carpi radialis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor, the insurance doctor said, there is absolutely nothing wrong with this man, and he can return to work at 100%, no disability. And he's a laborer. Now, how can you cut the most major tendon in your wrist and have no disability? You
mm-hmm.
see that? That
right.
doctor needs to be taken before his peers and
right.
have... His
hard and feathered.
Exactly. So, you know, I believe that as long as we have these doctors who are so unethical, And then as long as we have these patients that are so unethical, we do need an objective thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I work in this world.
Right.
And so, yes, because there are very good actors.
Right.
I mean, you know that.
Right.
I mean, look at people in these movies, you know, pretending like they're in horrible pain. They're excellent. You know?
Right, right.
So no, we do need some objective measures. And although I, as a clinician, can say, you know, I think he's faking it, or no, I think he's not faking it, that's a subjective opinion.
Right,
it's
right.
It's not good enough.
Right.
So
right.
I do think we need something, and I hope something develops. And I think it can, because when you understand this too, when there is pain in the body, if you look at it from a biophysical standpoint, there's something going on there.
Right.
There's some sort of signal filing there that we should be able to capture given enough knowledge in science and physics.
Right.
I mean, even if it's just nerve activity, you know,
right.
cuz you can't have pain without nerve activity, I don't
right.
think. I mean, if you cut the nerve to your leg, you can have phantom pain, but other than phantom pain, you have no other kind of pain, you know.
Right.
And that
right.
pain is in your brain, so it stills nerve, you know. So you should be able to document that somehow.
Yeah, I'm sure, and you know, I'm sure there are very sophisticated ways, like you know, using functional MRI or something,
mm-hmm.
Which sort of shows the areas in the brain that sort of get activated.
They're lighting up, yeah.
Light up.
Spectroscans, that's what they're called.
That what?
Spectroscans.
Right.
I think.
Right. Right.
I interviewed
right.
Dr. Amin, and I learned about spectroscans with him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we just need to test them, validate them, and then start using them. And then I think hopefully we can quantitate pain then. I mean,
right.
you should be able to. If it can be measured, it should be able to be quantitated. But don't you want to know if your therapy's working? Because,
sure.
you know, the placebo effect is so great. You know that.
Yeah. Yeah, but one of the you know, I mean, I'm all for some of these sophisticated mm-hmm. technology ways that we can sort of objectively quantify pain. But again, I would favor that in sort of the exception. That shouldn't be sort of the way we assess pain, by hooking somebody up to a machine. And I still believe that in the majority of the cases that we can do that on a sort of interpersonal level.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. It's only in these insurance and secondary gain cases. Because really, why would a person come into your office and say they have excruciating pain if they didn't? You know, like it's very rare.
and as you know, I'm big on language. But
yeah.
for example, when we're talking about the quantification, when we ask somebody, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, those numbers are kind of meaningless.
Right.
And you can't get any, who the heck knows what one number, you know, means for mm-hmm. one person and how does that relate to your number for your particular problem. But if you start to keep going on that, well, what does a 7 actually mean to you? What is it,
right.
how does it affect your, you know, your day-to-day, you know, you mm-hmm. can start. Once that dialogue, you know, starts going, then you have much more to go on.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of time fails to happen. And the same goes for the quality of the pain. You know, if you could sort of coax patients along into trying to describe their pain, studies really have shown that the better descriptions, in many cases, the better the doctor is at making the right diagnosis. And,
oh, absolutely. Because
yeah.
neuropathic pain is a class in and of itself. And there are certain things that work and certain things that don't for neuropathic pain. I mean, you can drug the patient to the point where they fall asleep just because they're drugged, but you better do some other things for neuropathic pain. I mean, you don't just treat it with narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work.
And my, you know, the other thing that I really believe is that the dialogue, which is important, which is important primarily for the physician to try to diagnose and treat pain, but also has another really important effect, and that is making the person who is in pain feeling less sort of isolated and lonely,
right.
which I really believe is a critical aspect of pain, and especially for people who have been in pain for long periods of time, especially for the chronic pain sufferer.
Right.
So that the more dialogue, it actually adds in and of itself, beyond the medicine and the diagnosis or whatever else is prescribed, in and of itself, the dialogue helps patients. And it could be, you know, words, and I also mentioned in my book, there's other kinds of ways to, other kinds of languages that can be helpful, whether it's, you know, visual kind of languages for kids who can't really talk and communicate. There may be others, but especially for those who suffer pain for long periods of time, some kind of communication can really be therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, the entire focus of a lot of the JACO ideas are to identify and to make sure that we're treating pain. And we just went through a JACO survey in my center, and it certainly is being more recognized by nursing. Now, whether it's being more recognized by physicians is more difficult to know, except those trained in pain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that your observations are very important just in the, you know, in the regular family practice and in general practice. But the problem is, of course, is that they're trying to see a patient every 5 minutes.
Right.
What do you do with that?
Right. Exactly.
I mean, maybe you can get them to qualify everything on a piece of paper called the pain sheet. You know,
right.
The doctor can glance at it, but what kind of conversation can occur in 5 minutes?
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see what the new healthcare bill has to do, you know, has to offer for pain. Do you have any idea if it's addressed in there, in the 4,500 pages?
I do not. I think everybody's waiting with bated breath to see what comes out. I don't really think there's anything very specific. My sense, from what I've heard, and I haven't really, you know, studied the document, but that it sort of suggests ways to but not specific kinds of things. And I'm not aware that there's anything about pain in the.
I'll have to ask Daniel Brinkley. I was interviewing him on one of his new books, and he said he's obsessive compulsive and had read all 4,500 pages.
Wow!
Of course, I'm not sure that was the bill that passed.
Right.
In fact, I'm pretty sure it wasn't, because that was back when the House was doing it. So it might be a different bill. But certainly, you know, I think the two biggest things that I can see in medicine would be preventative medicine, which really is needed to help control costs.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't educate people about their bodies and get some of the more dangerous things off the market that can harm people, I think we're going to have tremendously high medical bills. And then, the other thing, of course, is like what your book is about, which is why I'm interviewing you. I think it's a very important topic of what we can do to actually improve quality of life. Because there should be things that we are able to do so that at least the person is functional.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be a big battle in the world of pain management between, you know, just doing procedures to do things like burn nerves, give steroids, you know, whatever, procedural, versus the more pain management where you use long-acting narcotics and patches and other, even medicines that decrease nerve signals like Trileptal and Neurontin.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be, some doctors favoring just the procedural because, of course, you can make more money, and other doctors doing more the other because they're not as good at the procedures, which can be rather hairy.
And then you can have a third alternative, this sort of alternative stuff
that people are doing. Acupuncture. We have.
Sure.
I brought over several doctors from China who specialized in neurological acupuncture. How's that? You know, there are neurological hospitals in China because stroke is the number one killer.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot about controlling pain with acupressure points, which is called myotherapy and fibromyalgia,
mm-hmm.
Acupuncture. We use pain patches in our clinic that are biophysics-oriented rather than chemically-oriented. Of course,
mm-hmm.
I use lidoderm patch a lot. I wrote two scripts for lidoderm patch yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And it can really work. You know, someone who has the nerves of the back of their hand damaged with trauma, slap a lidoderm patch on it. Just numb the crap out of it. And guess what? The patient loves you.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, how simple is that? If you can't fix it surgically. But usually we can fix it surgically. The insurance company just won't let us.
Right.
You know, they've got the second opinion from the kind of doctor I talked about a few minutes ago who says there's nothing wrong.
Right.
The patient's faking it. And actually writes that in the thing as if the patient will never read that.
Right.
And I'm going, you know, that's just not very smart. To tell a person they're not in pain? You know, I'm sorry. That would get you sued. You know, eventually. But anyway, I don't know. I think medicine needs an entire overhaul sometimes. But we certainly need better technology. I think that's and better compassion. Your book is about compassion.
Yes.
Your book is about language and, you know, the communication that brings a patient out of isolation, which I think is very important. How does that? We all have had physical pain. Not all of us have had psychological pain, though. How does talking about your pain when you're having mostly psychological pain help you? Or do you think it does?
Well, one of the things that I really kind of believe, and it's a little bit probably controversial, or maybe a lot of it controversial, I'm not sure, is that we tend to sort of think too much in these very dualistic terms, the mind and the body and physical and mental. And you know what? It has probably practical, we do it for practical reasons in medicine.
Refer somebody to a psychiatrist with his mental.
Yeah. But you know what? I really don't see, after thinking about this for so long and after experiencing pain myself, I don't see it in these two sort of black and white kind of terms. I see it sort of as a spectrum. And that, yes, there are times where it seems more physical, and there are times where it seems more sort of purely psychological, but it's all in a sort of continuum, where there's always some of both. When you experience a lot of pain, physical kinds of pain, you're also in a lot of psychological pain. You can't sort of take one, you know, you can't just sort of, my sense is that there should be more of a holistic sort of interpretation of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a problem in medicine, that we think of it in these sort of two sort of opposing sort of camps, when medicine, surgery can't fix the pain, then they move on to the psychiatrist. But there should be more of a sort of dialogue within medicine because I think there's really a lot of overlap, whether it's the psychiatric patient with lots of physical symptoms, and they all do, or the cancer patient in pain with a lot of psychological symptoms. So, I mean, part of the answer to your question is, if that's the case, then there's more to it than fixing sometimes the physical injury. There's sort of repairing the psyche, the person, the individual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the other things that I think about a lot because of my experience as a patient, and thinking about medical reform, healthcare reform, and all of that, is that unfortunately, medicine isn't as patient-centered as it should be. We sort of forget about the patient a lot and deal with these sort of, you know, very physical disease sort of entities, mm-hmm. And sort of forget about the bigger picture. And it's and you could see this very much in the case of the pain. When we can't fix the physical problem, then the patient gets sort of thrust out of the system,
right,
and has nowhere to go. There's no place for the mm-hmm. for the person without the lesion on the CAT scan to go.
Right.
And it's disastrous. So in my utopian world, the patient gets back to the center of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're more receptive and more holistic in our approaches in healing.
Yeah, and I think we have to use the best of all worlds.
Right.
You know, drugs, surgery.
Yes, I'm not poo-pooing the medical surgical.
But you're right, everything.
Yes.
I mean, there are reports. I've done interviews on people who, doctors who wrote books on past life regression therapy. And there are documented instances of taking somebody into a past life where they saw that they had been stabbed in the chest with a spear or something. They removed the spear in this hypnotic state. They came back and their chronic pain was gone immediately. I mean, that stretches your imagination.
Yeah, and it's not
that's
so
real
different.
Holistic, and it doesn't limit it to this lifetime.
Well, it's not even that much different from your first example of the meningitis when you sort of go out of your body how does that happen?
Yeah, exactly.
And here's a perfect example of a certainly physical cause of pain,
mm-hmm.
And yet it could be modified by non-physical means somehow.
Yes.
How does that work? And
right.
How could we use that?
Well, and at 13,
how can we use
at
that?
13, I had never heard of an out-of-body experience.
Right.
So it's not something that I thought of and just, you know, decided to do, okay? But you know, I think that I have had a little bit of comfort, though, knowing that in myself and in my patients, when the pain got bad enough, there was something that could occur to free them of the pain. Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
That is, because I really believe that. Now, it may not be true in all cases, I don't know. But I was watching TV the other night, and there was a movie on that you may have heard of, You Don't Know Jack. Have you seen
it? No.
You may want to watch it.
Okay.
It's about Jack Kevorkian, and
uh-huh.
I think a famous actor.
Oh, I heard
remember.
About that. Who's playing Jack Kevorkian?
Oh,
is it Pacino?
Remember.
Is it
yeah,
one of those?
Yeah, it's Pacino. It is.
Okay.
It is. Fabulous job.
Okay.
And then I also saw Dr. Kevorkian being interviewed on one of the talk shows.
Okay.
And what is so interesting is his sense of humor, his whole philosophy. I mean, he's claiming that if we don't, I mean, we put our animals to sleep when they're in horrible pain. Not to do it for a human is inhuman, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, he obviously has what I would call a spiritual mission to bring this to the forefront.
Right.
I think, but the movie talks about how he got kind of in trouble because he didn't have enough people around him protecting him and protecting his methods. And that, you know, he should have had more of this and more of that. And that the gaps in that allowed the legal, the legal world, the prosecutors to come in, because like the physical test showed no evidence of this disease that she, you know what I mean? That,
yes.
But I can't help but think that Kevorkian is onto something in terms of if we could develop a system that was fairly, tight in terms of the prevention of abuse, the family just wanted them to be put down so they could get the inheritance, which is the obvious problem.
Right.
Or just someone who's depressed and could be treated.
Right.
And in You Don't Know Jack, he is actually refusing patient after patient, saying, no, there are methods for you to get better, and
right.
death is not, you're
right.
not a candidate for this.
Right.
But in any case, you know, if somebody is in horrible, horrible, excruciating pain for a prolonged period of time, it's interesting to, you know, if we could develop a system that prevented the abuses, could patient-assisted suicide be something that we should consider?
Yeah, no, I mean,
it's very, very interesting. And I know the religious right doesn't believe in it, but
right.
I doubt many of them have been in prolonged
right.
excruciating pain to,
right.
to the extent that this question would be applicable, you know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And again, Kevorkian wasn't killing patients. He wasn't pushing the substances in them himself.
Right.
It was that they had to do it themselves.
Right.
Even if they couldn't move their hand, some of them were paralyzed. They
right.
did it with their mouth with a string, you know. So it wasn't, I mean, I think people have a misconception that he was somehow killing people.
Right.
All he was doing was providing his machine that was kind of fairly complicated, but to kill them with no pain, you know, to kill them, mm-hmm. kind of put them to sleep first and then kill them.
Right.
With potassium chloride, I think that's what he usually used.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, it would be interesting to see if our society will move toward that, especially now that we have this healthcare bill.
Right.
Which does allow the government to possibly, you know, introduce this concept.
Right.
I mean, I think there's at least from what I've read on the internet, there's a possibility that either care could be withheld or other means could be used to determine that someone is not, you know, is not.
Well, that is a huge problem. End of life care and how much
you
spend on end of life care, and the fact that there's not a lot of talk with patients. You know, how many mm-hmm. patients have signed living wills?
It is living will.
Yes,
yeah.
but that the conversation is not broached quite enough of the time.
Family has to make a decision, and you know, as a trauma surgeon, I cannot tell you the number of times that, you know, making the family make that decision is kind of cruel and unusual punishment in some cases.
Right.
Either because the family members are not really old enough to do that, mature enough to do that, or prepared to do that. You know, it's not really good. I would think that we could come up with a system where we could have more of an ethics committee look at everything and advise the family on what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? You know,
yeah.
like
yeah.
something not connected with the hospital, because that would be financially, you know, especially if the patient didn't have insurance, there'd be a financial problem there. But some sort of a ethics committee where, you know, maybe for a fee, maybe for a couple
right.
hundred dollars, you know, the people, there'd be, you know, clergy on it, there'd be, you know, ethics professors or ethics mm-hmm. experts and doctors in the area where the, you know, if it was a neurological problem like brain death, there'd be a neurologist, you know. But just a committee that could advise the families, wouldn't that
right.
be a good idea?
Yeah.
I think somebody should start a company.
And it would probably be a relief.
Well, they can say the committee told me to do it, you know.
Well, and
that's about
well, yeah.
It's not a bad
no,
idea in some cases.
How could, I mean, it would be very hard to sort of make a decision to put your loved one.
Yeah,
you know.
And what knowledge do you have?
Right.
I mean, how long did the doctor spend even explaining to you? You talk about this in your book, that in oftentimes they don't even explain why the patient's in pain to the patient.
Right, right, right.
So, yeah, I think that would be a good idea, and I also think that, you know, that we really need as a society to address what we allow people to do. Now, I'll tell you what's being done now. I mean, I don't know whether you've been in hospice lately, but they set a bottle of morphine right by the bedside, liquid morphine,
mm-hmm.
right there. And I'll tell you something. I know patients are using that to kill themselves.
Right, right.
So that's how it's being handled now. And I've
right.
never heard anybody say that, but
right. sort of under the radar.
It was really funny. One of my friends is in hospice, and I was doing some spiritual work on him, and I did the spiritual work where, I don't know, I'd never done it before, but anyway, he couldn't sleep for 3 days because he had so much energy put into him. And so he said, but my hospice nurse told me about this little bottle by my bedside. I took some morphine. I fell right to sleep. Isn't that hilarious?
Yes.
So, but you got to be careful how much energy you put you pour into somebody when you're doing a healing, because one of the side effects can be insomnia.
Right.
But anyway, now he's his Emory doctors have said, we don't know why you're getting better, but you're getting better. Come see us in 3 months.
Wow.
So I think
wow.
he's still in hospice. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's many interesting things. So that's why I know a little bit about hospice, because I've got a good friend in hospice right now. But he actually had a liver tumor the size of a grapefruit, and it suddenly went away. You talk about spontaneous. I'm studying spontaneous remission.
Yeah.
And we did some maneuvers on him, and he had it documented on CAT scan. There was a surgeon and another radiologist that said, yes, it's definitely hepatocellular carcinoma. And then he actually had a GI bleed, went into Emory. When they did the MRI, there's no evidence of cancer. So there you go.
Mm.
That's what we need to be studying.
Right. And I mean, the other thing about hospice and palliative care is that model is what, you know, that kind of holistic sort of model, their approach, I think really, really would be a very good one to sort of model, you know, pain approaches on, because they really do, you know, it's not just the single, you know, physical medication, physical treatment. It's much more than that. And
that's,
I think,
because
they
have hospice nurses who specialize in this.
Nurses and I think a lot of the palliative
physicians.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's mainly the nurses. I mean,
the nurses usually are the ones who do get this stuff.
They bring it in.
They bring it in.
I know they do.
Well,
I
in fact, I think the whole if I'm not mistaken, it's it was a nurse, an English nurse, who started the whole hospice care movement. But that shouldn't be surprising that a nurse would initiate.
It's the same with midwives. You know, in midwives were always. Even had better success than the doctors did, because the doctors often gave the women puerperal fever and they died from it because they came from the autopsy room and didn't wash their hands. Whereas the midwives probably knew enough to wash their hands, so it was much safer to have a baby with a midwife. So, you know, there you are coming into life with a midwife and going out with a hospice nurse. And there are male hospice nurses, though.
Right.
There are.
Right.
They're very good male. My spiritual father had a wonderful male hospice nurse. Who was just, I mean, when his wife described to me what happened during that time, it was just amazing. You know, they're real experts in helping people transition. And they know who they are, you know, and they gravitate into the field. And it is more of a spiritual and holistic experience than one of straight, you know, scientific medicine. No question. No question. But thank goodness we have hospice. I think that saves a lot of suffering, mental suffering, for the family and for the person dying. And who wouldn't want to die in their own home rather than in a hospital bed?
Right, right.
I mean, I don't know very many people that would choose the former.
Yeah.
So, the latter. So we're coming up to the end of our hour here. Would you like to share your contact information and any other messages you would like to give out to our listening audience about what they should think about when they're in pain or when their loved ones are in pain?
I would say if I had a single sort of message, it's that, you know, pain is really very difficult as an experience to sort of communicate and get out there. But I think it's really critical to try. And I think the key here is imagination. And that goes for the patient as well as the doctor. That because it's so difficult as an experience to sort of, it's so private and subjective and as an experience, you really have to be very imaginative and creative. One of the things that, you know, I really believe is that you have to almost be a poet to communicate your pain. The language of pain is the language of poetry, really.
Metaphor.
To really successfully, and, you know, some of the best kinds of descriptions of pain sound like poetry, you know. the because they're filled with sort of metaphors. But that's the only way to do it. You know, whether it's a simple sort of metaphor, you know, the pain is stabbing, it feels
stabbing,
like a knife,
shooting,
it's like,
right.
but it's all metaphorical. And if you want people, if you don't, and the lack of communication is disastrous for people.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling of being
isolated
and cut off, and people
deserted, really.
People not hearing your
right.
pain
yeah.
is disastrous.
Right.
It just makes the pain even worse.
Mm-hmm.
So the key is to try, and the way to try is to be as imaginative as you can. Sort of
mm-hmm.
think about what things in the visible, sort of shareable world you can attach to your pain so that somebody else could see it. Because if somebody else doesn't see it, somebody else is not going to believe it,
right.
and somebody else is not going to be, you know, energized to sort of help. So that's my message.
Okay. Well, it's a book that's sorely needed. And, you know, not all of us will experience excruciating pain in our lives, except maybe temporarily, you know, obviously when you burn yourself or whatever. And there is a difference between the temporary acute pain that you might feel even with a surgical procedure
mm-hmm.
or an injury, and the chronic pain, psychological and physical, as you so aptly describe in your book, because they do merge in all cases. It may
mm-hmm.
start out physical, but it becomes psychological.
Mm-hmm.
It may start out psychological, but it ultimately becomes physical if
mm-hmm.
not treated, treated. And not all pain is able to be treated. I think we need to really recognize that we need to bring in the more holistic therapies, hypnosis, psychotherapy, traditional Chinese medicine, certainly physical therapy, and
mm-hmm.
and all of that is very important in
mm-hmm.
the treatment of fibromyalgia type pain and other pain related to the musculoskeletal system.
Mm-hmm.
So so I think that this book is maybe a good book for pain doctors to read, and doctors that treat pain in their regular population and don't just refer to a pain clinic, which is becoming all too common. And then, of course, any of the patients that are experiencing pain
mm-hmm.
as well. So,
and I'll even make it broader, because
mm-hmm.
I think there's just pain all over the place. I mean, you know, I started, you know, thinking about pain, you know, in the narrow sort of medical
mm-hmm.
sense, you know, my
yeah.
pain from
right.
the bone marrow transplant.
Yeah.
But you know what? I have pain, you know, when something happens to my kids.
Right.
And it's real pain.
Yeah, it is.
So, you know, I think it's more of a sort of common sort of part of our lives than we...
It is.
So
we will recommend it for anybody who's human. How's that?
How's that? That's perfect.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
So do you have a website that you would like to share?
I don't have a website,
okay.
No.
Well, then they can get your book on
Amazon or
whatever.
Bookstore, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We've been interviewing Dr. David Bureau, his book, The Language of Pain, Finding Words, Compassion, and Relief. Next week, we're going to talk about energy. Dr. Deborah Green, Endless Energy, The Essential Guide to Energy Health. And then after that, Dr. George Jade, Curing the Incurable with Holistic Medicine. And then Dr. Amit Goswami, one of my favorite physicists, on his DVD, The Quantum Activist, is on the 22nd. And then we have a free lecture by Dr. Brad Gould on the 13th of May. He's going to give a lecture on biophysics, how to balance your body without chemicals. And then, of course, we have our monthly Noetic Science meeting on the 20th, which is the third Thursday at 7:30. Shirley Chambers, who runs the local Kabbalah Center, will be giving a lecture on the fifth kingdom, a kingdom whose time has come. And if she's right, there is no pain in the fifth kingdom. Now that might be something to aspire to. What do you think?
Yeah, I think
yeah.
<so. laughs>
That might be a reason to do your spiritual work now. Because theoretically, according to metaphysics, pain is limited to the third dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the fourth too. Not sure. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, David. It's been a pleasure interviewing you.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Call with Temple of Health Radio Show, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Don't you
Bye-bye.
Just hate
Bye-bye.
Trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute. You look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plastikos.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone, skin, and contour the body. Endermology by Plastikos feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plastikos, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plastikos at 770-457-4677. Plastikos Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.